Well, welcome to the Food Professor Podcast, the first episode of 2022. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm the Food Professor, Sylvain Charlebois.
Well, Sylvain, it's wonderful to hear your voice. You and I have been exchanging emails and texts over the past, we haven't talked in a long time, so it's great to hear you, great to see you. And, how are you, my friend? How are you doing?
We're doing great. We're here in Florida. I'm a visiting scholar for the semester at the University of South Florida. Mm-hmm. They've been mm-hmm. awesome. We're actually designing a MOOC, a free online course
what's
for the
MOOC?
Public.
Yeah, what's a MOOC?
A MOOC is a free online course for the public. The University of South Florida uses MOOCs to recruit essentially students for credit, essentially, mm-hmm. and they've been quite successful. One of the MOOCs that they have on diversity has over 250,000 wow. registered students.
Wow!
And it's a very powerful recruitment tool for them. And so when I was approached by them to do something for them, I said, "Well, absolutely." And the topic is the future of food. And
wow.
So very popular, and I've been recruiting some guest speakers for the course, and I've had over 125 volunteers to guest lecture for free in the class. So yeah, it's been great. The support is awesome, and mm-hmm. Obviously the weather's nice. Our kids are in school here mm-hmm. In Florida, experiencing something unique, something different than in Canada. So we're doing great here. How about you, Michael? I know that you've been you were affected by this huge storm recently, 50 mm-hmm. centimeters. Oh my God! So are you doing okay?
Yeah, thank you. All's good. I mean, I'm supposed to be in New York actually today. There's a big trade show. It was virtual last year, but prior to that, I hadn't missed it in 20 years. And it's about like 50,000 people go to this trade show. It is one of the big, you know, marker points in the year.
In the last week, I've had three events canceled. So we had in-person events scheduled for the winter, and I was supposed to fly back to Canada for a few times for a few events, and unfortunately all of these were canceled. I think the next event is going to be Seattle, mm-hmm. where you and I will be meeting face to face again. So I'm looking forward to Seattle. I'm really just hoping it won't get canceled, because I really need Seattle. Seattle is a good show, a great show for food innovation. So, and we have our podcast there. We'll have a booth there, you and I, and so I'm just really looking forward to meet all of the people in the food industry at Seattle in person.
The date is April, right? Like the 21st of April is the number, I think. 21st,
that's
22nd,
right.
Or 23rd of April. So that's far enough out, I think. I mean, I mean, you and I were going to get together actually at the Restaurants Canada show, which typically is the first couple of days of March, but they moved their show, thinking that was like a month too early, I guess. I mean, you got to make a call on these big shows well in advance, right? It's very hard to be a conference planner, right?
You
got to make these calls. So they plan, I think it is now mid-May. I think it's the 9th or 10th, just to throw a date perspective. Now, this would be your fourth university, Guelph, Sask, Dal, and this one, at least four, right, that you've taught at.
I've been a visiting scholar. So I've been a professor in Saskatchewan, Guelph, and Dal, but I've been a visiting scholar at the University of Helsinki in Finland, at the University of Xi'an in China for a month. That was a few years ago. I was a visiting scholar also at the University of Innsbruck for 1 year, and now at the University of South Florida. So this would be number four. Yeah,
and this is, you know, so I just wanted to talk about that because so people understand your tradecraft, your life as a professor. This is the normal course of things, right?
You'd be invited
to different universities.
That's what we're expected to do, and obviously our research output is impacted by that. And of course, you get inspired by working with people who have a totally different perspective on certain issues. And so you want to be exposed to different perspectives. And of course, as you know, Michael, because you've been to America several times, they have a different way of looking at things. The scale is just not the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, and more so now than ever before. And you're in Florida, which is interesting.
Because we've been talking about the border in the news of late, and the vaccine mandate, and truckers, and I have to it's sad to say, but in America, Canada is not necessarily as important than the U.S. is for Canada. I mean, that's because here they have options. They have Mexico. They have 360 affluent consumers to service. I mean, it's just the game is just completely different. And that's why sometimes as Canadians, we tend to forget that we're just – you know, we're North America's New Zealand, really.
Well, it's so true because I'd often describe it as a diseconomy of scale in Canada, right? There's a lot of things that are very difficult to do. We have the geography. We don't have the people. We don't have the density. We have a lot of these things, which makes, you know, grocery and food and restaurants, that order of magnitude more complex. And, you know, we have great partners in the United States, and we import a lot of food, right, from Florida. I mean, citrus. I think when I think citrus, I think Florida, California, South Africa, and Israel, kind of in those, in that rank order. But the trade between just even the state and Canada is massive, right? Just in terms of
absolutely, and especially right now. I mean, in the winter, it's very, very critical for our food security.
Sure.
I would say that there are three hubs in America. There's obviously California, the Arizona hub as well, and also Florida. But as you know, Michael, over the years, that our procurement strategy as a nation has gone south a little bit further with Mexico and more so.
I think so. Anyway, let's get on with the show. And of course, we're back with Trying Stuff, our fun segment. And here's my Trying Stuff, the Strang Stuff.
That's right. And mine is in the fridge right now, ready to be drank. We brought it from Halifax. So looking forward to taste this.
All right. Silver Swallow Kombucha, the luxury kombucha. And this is from Ottawa, from our good friend Andrew Roberts sent us.
Now, do you like kombucha, Michael?
I've never had it before.
Are you serious?
So the good news and the bad news. The bad news is I can't compare this to any other kombucha. The good news is it's first time I'm trying it. It's January. We thought what a great time to try it, whether it's dry January or February. But I've never had it before.
I'm not a big fan of kombucha. I don't drink the stuff on a regular basis, but this seems like a really interesting product.
We've got a great interview with Adam Catt, an author. You heard him speak. He wrote a book, Life on the Grocery Line. It's the front line of grocery. He's got a very interesting perspective. So
I'll be honest. I was actually, I think I was at a hotel at some point traveling and saw him on CNN giving a really interesting interview. And he was talking about his book. And I immediately thought, we need to invite him. And he, so I couldn't find his coordinates. So I went on Facebook, found him on Facebook, and was able to connect. He doesn't have a communication agency or anything like that. So it was really easy to connect with him. And he's such a nice guy. My goodness.
Yeah, it's a great interview. And he's one of many that we have coming up. So we still have we've got great guests coming up. We just landed, for example, the president of Saint-Hubert, who's going to join us a little later, I think in March. But we've got lots of great guests lined up and lots of things to talk about. So let's get to talking about a few key issues. You've already kind of mentioned them. I mean, I got to think at the top of our list, you know, this vaccine mandate that the government put in place so the truckers can't pass by the border. Now, you know, you can imagine the difficult place that the government was in from a policy perspective, and even companies were in from a policy perspective. I mean, basically, you know, okay, you got to get vaccinated. Many organizations have fired lots of employees because they put in a mandate. So it's not unusual, but you're
and
thinking,
some transport companies have actually offered substantial bonuses to entice truckers to get vaccinated. $2,500
isn't moving the needle, right? You're right, because I talked to people he said, well, at first it was two, then it was five, then it was 1,000, and then it's a bonus of 25 for that, and still not moving the needle. And it's, you know, I saw, you tell me, but I saw numbers like 25%. So it seems a community that is over-indexing and on vaccinations, and now we've got a problem.
I mean, it's at the end of the day, I think 2 years into this pandemic, if you haven't gotten a jab yet, chances are I don't think you'll get it. I mean,
unless my one data point for you from your home province of Quebec, they mandated that to go in the liquor store or their cannabis store, you had to be vaccinated. They had a 2,000% increase or some kind of crazy increase in vaccinations. Like at the end of the day, money incentive doesn't seem to be
Well, that number came from the government. I'm not sure if it's actually entirely accurate, to be honest. There's still going to be many Djokovic's out there not wanting. I mean, I actually do believe that there's about 10% of the population who just won't get the jab no matter what.
Yeah, that's been a consistent stat. That's been a very consistent stat in Canada, yeah. 10 to 15%.
And trucking is the same percentage. And so
it
mirrors what we see in society. But that 10% is quite critical because we're already short 18,000 truckers already. And so it's just going to add to the deficit that we have with trucking. So that's 8 to 16,000 on the Canadian side, and that's about 125,000 on the American side. And so the mandate is actually going to start on the U.S. side on Saturday, January 22nd. So I've always been concerned about the vaccine mandate, not because of the mandate itself. I mean, if the government believes that a mandate is important, so be it. It's just the timing. I mean, the timing is not great.
But if not now, when? I mean, you got a community that's never going to get vaccinated, and you know, it's not like 18,000 truckers are going to suddenly show up in May. Like
Omicron has completely paralyzed the. It's awful right now. I mean, I was actually on the phone yesterday with two CPG companies, and they're operating with 20%, 30% less people around. And so it's obviously you could see before the holidays that things were slowing way down because of Omicron. And then, of course, you have January in the middle of winter when we buy a lot of food from the U.S. It's about $25 billion worth of food every year, wholesale from the U.S. 70% of it actually goes through the border on wheels. And so there's a lot of business going on between Canada and the U.S.
Yeah. And of course, food consumption is food consumption, but in Ontario, Quebec, restaurants are closed. So that food consumption means it's going to happen in the grocery store by and large, right? In two of the biggest provinces.
And then, of course, you add recalls. There was a major recall of salads, and that takes away more food from the market. And snowstorms. You guys went through a snowstorm recently. That slows things down, too. I just felt that really this mandate adds fuel to the fire at the worst time. I think it would have been more prudent for the government to just wait until we're done with Omicron,
spring or something. If all goes well, at least the.
Because I got a couple of memos last night from CPG companies in confidence, and it's not. I mean, the worst is yet to come. I mean, we're going to see. I'm predicting that we're going to see some grocery stores temporarily close as a result of what's going on right now, because you just can't operate all of the stores right now that are and have them half empty. It's just you can't do that. So you're going to see some stores close so they can service the public. I think Canadians will continue to have access to food they need, but you won't have as many choices for a while.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good clarification, because there is still, I guess it's about choice. We've been talking about that. I've been talking about that for months, basically, because of the supply chain. Basically, you know, you might not have the brand you want. You might not have the size you want. You might not have the color you want. But consumers need to be more willing to substitute. Now, that's a more specific thing when it comes to food. But maybe you're having frozen blueberries instead of fresh blueberries shipped through the U.S. kind of thing. Is that what you're thinking? Like those kind of choices?
Pretty much, yeah. Obviously, I don't think there's any reason to panic. But I am concerned, and of course you saw Stats Canada's release this morning. Food prices are up 5.7% now, so we're above 5% steady.
As you predicted in the
as we predicted price, exactly, yeah. And so as we take more truckers out of the system, the economics of food distribution in North America is simply this for Canada: if you want truckers to service Canada with fewer people around, you got to pay them more.
Right.
You got to pay them
or
more.
Or put it on an airplane. I mean, you can put it on an airplane if you
and flying is more expensive too. And so that's really the reality. So I actually do think that there's going to be some food, not as much as we used to see, but there's going to be some food for the next little while, but that food is going to get more expensive, unfortunately.
Well, let's segue into we've already kind of got a prediction, I guess, but you know, we ended our last season, our last year, with your top stories for 2021. What do you think? And, you know, what predictions do you have for? Are you in the? You know, how, do you have a working crystal ball there with you? Did you bring that from the office? Like, what are you thinking for 2022? Is on your mind?
Well, I think 2022 will be a tale of two stories, I guess. So we're actually in the middle of the first story, which is not going to be great. Things are going to be choppy and messy, and we're going to see a frugal customer. But as we get over that hump, and actually I'm pretty optimistic, I think we're starting to see the end of the pandemic. I don't know. I'm not a epidemiologist, but I'm actually hopeful that that Omicron will lead us into an endemic, I hope. And if it is the case, then people will feel more comfortable still with masks. Or, I mean, I think people will continue to be very careful, as they should. But at the same time, people will start thinking about the future again. People will start planning again. People will start moving around again. And of course, the food industry will probably follow. Food industry is very resilient, so it will follow the consumer, who will feel more confident about the future. That's what I'm expecting going into the spring.
All right,
I do think, I mean, the one message that resonates with me, I actually do think that we need to strike a more functional, from a food security perspective, I mean, we need to strike a more functional balance between saving lives and making sure that Canadians are fed. And I'm not sure we're there yet, to be honest. And so there's more work to be done there. We have to be realistic about how we can stop this virus, how we can win against the virus. I don't think we can win against the virus. The virus will be with us. And so that's why I'm very concerned about this fantasy of getting rid of the virus. I don't think it's actually possible. And it's for like the food industry, from a policy perspective, implications are huge.
All right. Well, that's a cut it. Predictions, but we got a whole year ahead of us.
Exactly.
Until the summer to talk about this is wonderful. All right. Well, listen, you've got some kombucha in the fridge. Why don't you go grab that? And then we'll try our product for our Trying Stuff segments. Welcome back, everyone, to our Trying Stuff segment, which is a very popular segment, both here on the podcast and on YouTube. Today, Silver Swan Kombucha, the champagne of kombucha. Thank you to Andrew Roberts. This is an Ottawa-based company. And,
yes, where you're from.
Where I am from. That's right, my hometown. Now, a couple of interesting things. Andrew sent this to us a while ago.
Yes.
And we've got lots of food coming up. You can see some in my background if you're on YouTube. So we've got a great series. And we said, when's a good time to have this kombucha? It's, whether it's a dry January or a dry February, now's a pretty good time. So I have to say, as I said earlier, I've never tried kombucha before.
Can't believe that, but anyways, there's 0.5% alcohol.
Yeah,
0.5.
I think they have to. You know, Andrew might tell us, but they probably have to say, well, there's some. There's probably like not zero, and they probably have to say, well, there's some. So it's in a champagne cork. So I just uncorked it. Let's open it up. There we go.
We opened up at the same time.
Well, this is almost like celebrating New Year's Eve. How's it smell?
Yes, happy New Year!
Yeah. It's got a nice.
Wish you would have more wine companies sending us samples.
I know. As you know, as I've related, I'm a big fan of champagne. I love the color, nice straw based color. It's got an effervescence to it.
Very nice color. Can you see through it? And very bubbly. It smells good too, huh?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. It's got a nice nice note on the tongue.
Yeah, that's right. Power to fermentation.
So let's talk about this market. I mean, kombucha is a thing. I mean, it's been a thing for decades in the small health food niche, but it's really exploded.
It's growing.
I see it in every store in every which way. And talk about the growth of these I don't know, would I call them health beverages? What category would these fall in?
I think most people are actually attracted to kombucha for because of their health, and of course there's a lot of focus on gut health in recent years, and kombucha really fits well with that space, right? Mm-hmm. People who are concerned about health and so the product, the category, which has grown immensely in recent years, is very much attached to this health lifestyle, the healthy lifestyle sort of thing. So I'm not too surprised that what's nice to see are great Canadian brands like this mm-hmm. one being successful out there and doing very well. So it's 'cause there's lots of competition, right? As soon as you see a category grow and be created, it attracts more competition.
A lot of attention. I think, you know, from a bespoke, you know, from a presentation perspective, you know, it's wonderful. I mean, I would put this on a dining room table with friends. And if you have friends who are maybe celebrating your dry January or dry February, whatever it is, it's a delicious option. It's got the effervescence of a champagne.
The category kind of took off about 5 years ago. And before that, I mean, most people made their own kombucha at home, really.
What was the catalyst for the acceleration in the category? Like,
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that people wanted a healthy drink, and all of a sudden people wanted something else, and there were some successful brands out there which promoted mm-hmm. the whole concept of kombucha, and instead of just making your own at home, you can actually buy it. Price points are fairly high. Mm-hmm. You really can't drink this at once. You have to. That's the thing about kombucha is a bottle like this, you have to share it. You can't really drink the whole thing on your own. I mean, you just can't. It's too much. And so this is the one thing that's been an issue with that category, is that price points tend to be really high. Mm. And so for people who continuing on to make kombucha at home, just actually continue to make kombucha at home. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, this was delicious. So thanks again to our friends. Thanks again to our friends at Silver Swallow.
Great delicious. Product.
We'll look for it. We'll put a link into Silver Swallow to go to the website. You can find out where you can pick some up. And for now, that's our Trying Stuff episode. All right. Let's wrap up. First, let's get to our interview with Adam. So let's have a listen to our interview with Adam. Again, you heard him on CNN. I got a copy of his book. His book's available on Amazon. It's a unique, interesting perspective from the front line of the grocery line. He started just before the pandemic. You've discovered his life as a writer. So let's have a listen to that interview right now. All right. Well, Adam, welcome to the Food Professor Podcast. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Well, our pleasure. You're our first guest in the 2022 season. So, Van, how are you doing? Everything good?
Very good. Yeah, it's great. I'm so happy that Adam accepted our invitation. I saw one of his interviews. I think it was in Chicago. And I thought, wow, what a compelling story. We need him. We need him on our podcast. So I'm very happy to have Adam join us this morning.
Yeah, excellent. So where are we reaching you today, Adam? Where are you having your cup of coffee today?
I live in Denver, Colorado.
All right. Well, listen, let's jump right in. Tell us a bit about yourself.
So, I've lived in Denver since I'm 36 years old. I lived in Denver since 95. So I've been here a long time. Went to school here, college here. Didn't really like college very much. Didn't really fit my attitude. I like to argue with professors a lot. We got a professor on here.
I get a lot of those in my classes.
Yeah. I was one of those guys that just wanted to get through college. So I don't know. I just got a degree to get a degree. And I think it was part of that generation too, where you didn't really have maybe as many options, or you didn't think you had options. And, after college, I bounced around, did like corporate jobs. I just kind of took a job to take a job. My passion over the last decade, more like 15 years, has really become writing. Started a few different blogs. I had a beer blog called the Denver Hopper that I would review breweries. And it was a lot of fun because I get, a lot of free drinks and got to develop my voice on the page.
Good strategy.
Oh, it was great. Like, I started doing distilleries and I got free bottles out of that. And I was like, this is the life right here.
But fantastic. Now, were you always a bit of a writer? Like when you go back and look back, you know, were you always journaling or noting, or is that something that came to you later in life?
You know, I was actually looking through my parents gave me a bunch of old stuff that's just been sitting in their garage. And I guess I won a lot of author awards and literary awards in school, but I wouldn't say I was a big reader. I didn't really read until probably towards the end of college. Mm-hmm. Like everything else was not for fun. And like part of it was the school I went to for high school. I went to a really strict Christian school. So we didn't read anything we didn't read like The Grapes of Wrath or anything amazing like that. It was very restrictive. So I got into reading and writing quite a bit later in life, but became pretty immersed right away when I figured out that that's the best way for me to process things in this world is working through stuff is on the page. After college, after the corporate life, I kind of came to a head in 2019. I decided to quit. I had a novel in mind that I wanted to write, and I needed some time to reevaluate my life. So I took the rest of 2019 off, actually got to a draft stage on that novel, and now I read it and I'm like, it's not great. But so I started working in the grocery store.
Yeah.
In 2020, in January of 2020, to just make money and really to keep my head free while working on the book. And then everything went, you know, shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
In other words,
in all kinds of ways, right? In all kinds of ways, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Mid-March. I mean, that's when school shut down here.
Yeah.
Everyone was, you know, started working from home. And it went from what was going to be like kind of a throwaway job, I guess, which is a harsh way to put it, but to me, it was just to kill time.
Yeah. Make ends meet, you know, put some money in the bank and move you to the next thing. Right.
Exactly. And like kind of, use my gift of gab. I like talking to people. I really do. It can be really entertaining and just like, you know, I don't know, poking fun or making fun of someone and having fun with them is a blast. So, I started a blog in April of 2020 to deal with what was going on because it was so stressful and life was so crazy. You know, a following grew almost immediately on Facebook, and people were connecting. They were telling me their stories. They were so worried about their family members, and everyone was worried. And it really became a community, and it grew and grew, and I kept sharing stories. So eventually I figured the best way to turn all those stories into something relatable and fun, because I'm not as much of a journaler as I should. That's shame on me for being a writer that's not journaling all the time. But I turned those blog posts into a narrative that follows Daniel the first week on the job as the pandemic hits. And it's very autobiographical, but it's a work of fiction. I call it almost a memoir, but I can't really call it a memoir because there's a lot of fictionalized stuff in there too.
Like those movies that are based on real life events. So let's talk about your book, The Grocery Line, A Frontline Experience in the Global Pandemic. So first of all, congratulations. You've published a book. That's a big deal.
This is your first book, Adam, right?
Yeah. It's my first book.
Congratulations. That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's a pretty amazing feeling to really come out of 2020 with something so life-changing and meaningful and out of all
that. Have you ever thought that your first book would be about groceries?
Never in my wildest dreams, man.
I bet. Now, in terms of the book itself, it's a really fascinating read. And so you decide to basically write this book, and it's a very unique product because I don't believe I've seen another book talking about, you know, a frontline experience at the grocery store during a pandemic. But I'm curious to know, what are some of the things that you think people should know about the grocery business in general from your perspective? Because you worked at a grocery store, you thought about your experience, you convey your experience in this book. What are some of the things that you think people should know about the grocery store, but they don't know?
You know, one of the major things that I learned when I started working there, so I got like maybe just a month and a half, 2 months before things got crazy. Mm-hmm. And you realize quickly that it's a whole, like it's a small town almost, you know, it's like 200 some odd employees at the one I was at. It was a big store, but it was, it's a whole like world in and of itself. It's like this, there's receiving going on all the time. We had a prepared foods, which I would manage. I didn't manage the whole thing, but I managed part of it later. So they had a whole kitchen there. You had this whole like microcosm going on. I describe it as mitochondria of the cell. It's like it was in the, it's the epicenter of so much action going on, and you have no idea. You just think like you go in, get your stuff, and you had a lot of people. I call them Lindas and Daves in the book. So it's like an archetype of very affluent, dismissive group of customers that you deal with on every third person, probably maybe even more. And it's just a lot of people that like they had air about them, or they didn't care, or they would like, you know, some people wouldn't talk to you. It's kind of strange. I don't know. Like
they actually came to you and it's like you didn't exist.
Yeah. Like that would happen a lot. You know, it's like a class thing, very much a class thing. That's not everyone though. And this store was super busy. So I would meet lots of nice,
right? You meet all kinds of different types of people. It's, you know what, when I was reading through your book and I started thinking about, as you said, some of the stories you were telling, it's like, I always wonder if you don't like being in a grocery store, why don't you just shop online? Like you can eliminate the whole process if you want.
Yeah.
It's not like that's not an option for you. If you dislike people so much.
One thing I really learned from the pandemic, especially when everything shut down and people had to go shopping still for their families. So they're trapped inside their house with their families. Mm-hmm. Is that we really need each other. Like even just any conversation, like strangers, I didn't have anyone directly cry in front of me. Heard about it a lot through people. Just people were like breaking down in real time.
In the store?
Yeah. Like just talking about like what they were going through and maybe just the heaviness of the moment of having to like worry about your kids in a whole different way. And then I don't know if you remember when they said like, you know, pets could transmit it, all sorts of weird stuff. Like,
yeah,
it's just such an uncertain and weird time that
there were so many unknowns. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
About the virus.
Wiping down groceries. I remember we had to wipe down the entire register between every person, including the credit card machine. And my arm got sore. We did that for like 2 weeks or something. And you'd do it so much that your arm would get sore.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people, we just need like camaraderie. So you'd have a lot of like really like pleasant conversations. We were so busy that you get a mix of everything, but mm-hmm. you know, people were just really worried and they needed someone to talk to. They're just begging for someone to talk to mm-hmm. besides their significant other about whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was in that way. It was really, I felt it was kind of rewarding to be like a therapist for a short period of time. Exactly. It also became kind of heavy too, you know?
Yeah.
Did you wish that like you went into this pandemic with only 2 months experience really at a grocery store? Did you hope at some point that you would have had more experience going into the pandemic, or is that something that you've never thought about?
Well, I've worked in like, even in the corporate world, I worked customer service. So like business to business customer service. And that's what I do now. It's just basically, you know, your pajama class and you're in the pajama class and you type emails, but you're still dealing with customers. So a lot of experience with that. I worked at like Sam's Club all through college, and a lot of experience with people and a lot of dealing with that sort of stuff. So mm-hmm. I feel like I had a lot of experience. There was a steep climb to be able to like, you know, all the, just to handle the pace, I think was the big thing.
Yeah.
And then the mm-hmm. pace just went bananas in the middle of March when, you know, all of a sudden we had empty shelves and everyone's got this look on their face like they've been up all night waiting.
I guess it didn't matter if you had experience or not because everything was new for everyone.
Yeah,
everything was so different. Exactly. Yeah. Like you just had to go with it. And kind of I decided early on that I was going to lean into it too. I just was going to embrace this moment. I knew it was unique in so many ways and it was scary and doom scrolling Twitter, but still I decided to lean in. I think that was to my benefit for sure.
You know, as you step back and think about your experiences and the experiences you relate and the stories that you tell in the book, what's your kind of thoughts on advice for the folks who run grocery stores? And your advice for the people who go to grocery stores? I mean, be more kind would be kind of one of those things. don't be a, you know, anyway. But if we think about, you know, you've got that, as Sylvain says, that frontline experience, and that's a unique perspective that you've written about. You know, if I waved a magic wand and gave you, millions of dollars to open your own store, how would it function differently? What would be different about it as a way of giving advice back to the industry and the grocers?
You know, in Denver right now, King Soopers is our Kroger, Kroger brand. And they're, it's a huge grocery store chain, and they're striking right now for their wages raised. And I remember we got hero pay or whatever you wanted to call it. Like you got a $2 bump an hour. Mm-hmm. And then they took it away at the end of the year. And I understand like margins are thin. I understand it was supposed to be temporary. Like there's a lot of moving parts to it. And grocery stores do not have a high margin. But like, I almost look at the Chick-fil-A model. Their employees are so friendly and they're really well paid. They look great. They're like, they look you in the eyes, which is kind of strange, but they're like, it's a pleasure. And I'm like, oh, this is weird, but okay. But it's a good model as far as motivating employees to do their best. I feel like they do a good job of that. And I know they offer really good benefits, really good pay. And I think college help and stuff. And I think if anything, the grocery store industry could focus a lot more on their employees. It's a job that's hard a lot of times. It's a grind. You know, you're dealing with angry customers, long hours. It's can be labor intensive, and it's thankless in a lot of ways. People don't even think about you when you go in. I think that's one thing that.
Do you think the pandemic has changed that? Do you think people are actually thinking more about grocery store employees than they used to?
You know, I worked from January all the way, January 2020 to May of 2021. And I didn't see much change by the end of that. It might be my store. It really, like I said, it's stratified, I guess you could say. And it was a grind. Like I worked I was in management and it wore on you. I had like just a few more dollars an hour and I was so worn out all the time. And the company didn't seem to care. Like they just went about their business, but I get that too. I understand where they come from. It's like customers. I think when you go into a grocery store, if you can remember to look people in the eye, maybe say their name and just be not such a rush, you know, be generous with your time just a little bit. You know, it can make a difference to even say someone's name. It's nice to have eye contact and be pleasant. And if you go in there a lot, like you don't have to be friends, just, you know, treat them with respect and dignity and like, oh, you're trying your best, you know, because they can't stop the supply chain. They have nothing to do with it almost.
Yeah.
You know?
Will the food industry see Adam again at some point?
Well, so technically I still do work in food industry. I can't talk about that company because I work there, but it's
so you're back in the food business. That's great.
I traded one headache for another and just
you're going through another phase of the pandemic from a procurement perspective, not from a retail perspective. So you're still in the middle of it. So are you going to write another book?
Just keep moving jobs and start writing.
Get the inspiration from your work.
I have a second one in mind that I'm working on. I think a grocery store is a fascinating place. It's like I said, a microcosm. There's so much going on there and there's so much life. There's young people that are just going to be there for, you know, a summer basically. And then there's people that have been working in a grocery store for 30 years.
Sure.
You have these different personalities. You have a lot of stuff going on. And that's any retail really. And even like service industry, like, servers and cooks and all that stuff, restaurants. It's that same sort of atmosphere. And I think it deserves a novel. I think it deserves someone to write about it in a meaningful way and really capture what I loved and hated about working in a grocery store and how it relates to bigger things in life. So that's my goal with the next one, which sounds enormous, but...
Well, good luck. I mean, that, you know, as Sylvain knows, I'm not an author. Sylvain has published books. I barely have time to read books, let alone write them. So, congratulations. It's been wonderful chatting with you because, as Sylvain said, right off the top, you know, you bring us a unique perspective on our show a unique perspective and advice from your wisdom. How can people get in touch with you? I guess the book is available. We have a mostly Canadian audience. It's available on Amazon.ca. How can people stay in touch or keep up with what you're writing and tell us a bit about all that stuff?
The book is available on Amazon.ca for the Canadian audience or Amazon.com for anyone that's in the US. And I'd say I'm most active on Facebook. You can look up Life on the Grocery Line. Twitter. I would love to grow more of a Twitter following. That's a challenge in and of itself.
Well, you know what? Yeah. We'll put links in the show notes. So if anyone's listening wants to follow you, we'll make it super easy.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Make sure that listeners are aware. The title of the book is called Life on the Grocery Line, A Frontline Experience in a Global Pandemic by Adam Jonathan Cott, published by Inspired Forever. Yeah. Great book.
Adam, thanks again for being on the Food Professor podcast. It was a real treat chatting with you, and I wish you much continued success and success in that second book and whatever you tackle next.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. This has been a pleasure, and I can't wait to listen to the podcast. I'll check it out.
All right. Last thing I wanted to talk to you about was it seems Canada's got a few dings on the policy NAFTA trade side. I called it NAFTA, but there's something going on with New Zealand.
NAFTA 2.0, yeah.
I think we lost a couple of rulings in the dairy side. What's going on in the trade regulation side that we should know about? Because it seems
On dairy, it's pretty simple. So there's a tribunal now that was set up by the United States, Mexico, Canada trade deal, which replaced NAFTA. It was ratified a couple of years ago. So they've set up this new tribunal, and for the first time, it was tested by the Americans. They contested Canada's, I would say, method of distributing importing quotas, like domestically. So the deal itself allows the Americans to import for about 3.5% of the milk production we see in Canada over 5 years.
That's the basic. That's a basic deal baked into CUSMA, the new NAFTA 2.0, right?
Exactly.
Basics. Okay.
Now, domestically for us, we had to figure out, well, who has the right to import these dairy products? So what we did was to give many of these quotas to dairy cooperatives and companies that are owned by dairy farmers. As you can imagine, they have zero incentive to import anything, really. And if they do import something, it would be of low quality. So basically, the United States called on Canada, called it, and they won. And so, of course, that is certainly bad news for the Canadian dairy sector because our scheme, we kind of cheated basically. And so we should take the blame for it. But here's the thing, Michael, is that we have a trade agreement with Europe and we have a trade agreement with New Zealand and Australia. Guess what's going to happen next? Because we have similar trade deals with them. They're going to contest.
Yeah, what's the European agreement?
That's been the game since day one. So we've ratified a lot of these trade deals But we didn't really commit to opening up our border, at least not 100% yet, because of this scheme of giving quotas to companies, organizations that wouldn't be motivated to actually import anything at all, really, to service Canadians. So I was actually kind of happy that the United States actually challenged Canada on that one. And I think at the end of the day, Canadians will benefit from the decision.
So it would be your assessment. I remember back to the days before we had NAFTA, where we'd get into trade agreements, disagreements with the U.S., and basically we'd be on the losing end of every agreement because there was no real great resolution process. And I, one of the things I liked about the NAFTA agreement is that there was a process, there was a tribunal. So in there's actually a question here coming, if I can get it out, which is, you think the tribunal process is a fair process? Like, we weren't on the, you know, the short end of a wrong process. You think the tribunal process as it sits to resolve trade disputes is a fair, balanced process? Because that wasn't always the case pre-NAFTA. You had to, you know, the big giant U.S. going, yeah,
right,
I'm going to do what I want and take you to the world court.
I don't know about the process that was put in place, whether or not it is fair for Canada particularly. But for this particular decision, I must say that the Americans are right. I mean, they are right. I think we have cheated. We've never committed to the promises we've made in spirit of the trade deal. We kind of just decided, well, let's actually allow more dairy products from the United States. But at the end of the day, we'll just give our quotas to people who don't want to really more competition in Canada.
And how fast, you know, this is fairly recent. How fast do you think the implications or reverberations of this are going to happen for the Canadian consumer? Is that a this year thing?
It's certainly bad news for the dairy sector because they're now exposed internationally. I mean, this news, this decision was broadcast internationally, so obviously other trade partners will go after Canada. That's really essentially what's going on right now. So it doesn't matter if the trade deal between the United States and Mexico is fair for Canada. More heat is coming.
Interesting.
From
interesting.
Other parts of the world.
Well, you know, we've talked about great things. We've talked about some concerns. It's been an interesting podcast. It's a great way to start the year. That's such an, you know, may you live in interesting times, right?
Exactly.
And listen, it was great to see you and talk with
you
again.
Great to see you, Mike. Yeah,
I've missed that over the past, what is it, almost been a month, but we're back. We're back. And we've got great episodes coming up with great guests, lots to talk about, more great products for trying stuff. So for now, let's wrap the episode. If you liked what you listened to, you can find us on all the major podcast platforms. Please subscribe so it automatically shows up. Visit our YouTube site where you'll see some extended content and, of course, our trying stuff. You can watch us drink kombucha and see what happens with my tummy that's kind of moving around right now. We'll see what's going on down there. A little bit of fun. Anyway,
psychological.
It's a delicious product.
Why don't you drink the whole bottle and see what happens?
I have to actually host a live event this afternoon, so I think I'm going to do that tomorrow.
Exactly.
And maybe I'll reverberate that tomorrow. Anyway, great to see you. Stay safe, and let's keep in touch. And for all the listeners, we'll be back again with our next episode. Thanks for tuning in to the Food Professor Podcast.
Take care.